Welcome to this audio descriptive guide to volcanoes and earthquakes. This guide combines descriptions of key objects and explanatory text from the wall panels. Played straight through, this guide will last about 40 minutes. You can pause at any time.
Introduction to the exhibition. Volcanoes and earthquakes have shaped the surface of our planet for billions of years. Heat from Earth's core moves tectonic plates at the surface, generating the dramatic forces that cause volcanoes and earthquakes. They bring death and destruction to millions, but also produce the elements and minerals we depend on. By monitoring and studying them, scientists have finally begun to understand these giant forces of nature. The exhibition is in three sections: volcanoes, plate tectonics, and earthquakes. It is organized along a single long gallery, about 7 paces in width, with exhibits on both sides, and a central spine of islands containing more exhibits and benches. As well as this long gallery, there are 2 larger areas at either end. An introductory room offers an overview of the themes, while at the far end there is an interactive earthquake simulator. Our journey through the exhibition zigzags back and forth across the gallery to take in exhibits on both sides, including many touchable objects. Please note that the rich soundscape is at some points loud and intense, and that at weekends and in school holidays, the exhibition can be very busy.
Earth's dynamic forces. A large space introduces the themes of the Volcanoes and Earthquakes exhibition. A long step display table, rising from right to left, holds 4 large touchable rocks. 3 of the rocks have a flat, polished surface where they've been sliced through to reveal the dramatic effect of underground heat and pressure. The rock furthest to the right, displayed just below waist level, is a chunk of granite with a dolerite intrusion. Pink and grey mottled granite is divided horizontally by a deep band of black. Molten rock, called magma, rich in iron and magnesium, forced its way through the granite, splitting it in 2. Magma is a mixture of red-hot molten rock, crystals and gases. When the magma cooled, it formed the dark dolerite. To the left, on the same level, is a vertical slab of folded gneiss, spelt G-N-E-I-S-S. The vast forces that bend and twist Earth's surface are recorded in ribbons of pink, black and grey, created as the rock was heated and squeezed deep underground. The 3rd rock to the left is displayed at chest height. This is an example of hydrothermal breccia. About halfway across the rough grey surface, a narrow black line runs from top to bottom. A violent, high-pressure injection of superheated fluid shattered and fractured this pink granite. As the pressure inside the rock decreased, the black mineral tourmaline formed from the fluid, binding the granite fragments. The 4th rock, at shoulder height, is a polished slab of granite with a xenolith inclusion. The pink and grey speckled granite has a large section of a different rock embedded into it on the left-hand side, black, striped with olive green. As magma rises towards Earth's surface, it cools and forms rocks such as granite. Here, the liquid magma has picked up a piece of black rock and incorporated it into the cooling granite, forming a xenolith, which means foreign rock. Leaving the 4 rock samples, turn to your left and cross the space diagonally to face a large screen about 2 metres tall and 3 metres wide on the wall opposite. It shows a projected map of the world. Just in front of the screen, a stand with a sloping surface at waist height has 3 large touch-sensitive circles. Press the button on the left and tiny red lights appear on the map to show the scores of volcanoes which have been active since the year 2000. Press the central button to illuminate tiny green lights, indicating where large earthquakes have occurred over the same time span, mainly in Asia. The button on the right illuminates in blue the tectonic plate boundaries, crossing oceans and continents. Both volcanoes and earthquakes are found clustered along the plate boundaries. To the right of this map, a smaller screen displays photographs of the largest recent volcanic explosions and earthquakes, showing devastated landscapes and homes, ash clouds and tsunamis.
Volcanic eruptions, stratovolcanoes. From the map and slideshow, the main gallery opens off to your right. We move into the volcano section. When a volcano erupts, things change. For many, an eruption brings fear, death, and destruction, altering the course of lives and civilizations. For others, it can inspire art, religion, and science. In some parts of the world, eruptions are a constant threat. But here in Britain, we haven't had one for 55 million years. A volcano is an opening in Earth's crust where magma, a mixture of red-hot molten rock, crystals and gases, erupts onto the surface. Once on the surface, it's called lava. How violent that eruption is depends on the type of magma, its chemical composition and the amount of gas in it. Some volcanoes explode violently, while lava oozes gently from others. The next section compares explosive and effusive eruptions. On the left-hand wall, a touchable display mounted on a long counter illustrates the most familiar type of volcano, the tall cone produced by explosive eruptions, known as a stratovolcano. Explosive volcanoes throw burning ash, poisonous gases, and fragments of magma high into the air. They are a major threat to human life. Stratovolcanoes, like the one shown in this model, are tall with steep sides, built out of layers of volcanic ash, debris, and cooled lava flows. They're formed when plates, the enormous, closely fitting slabs of rock that make up Earth's surface, move against each other. Where one plate is forced under another, in a process called subduction, it usually forms magma with high gas content. This is the type that causes explosive eruptions, leading to the familiar steep-sided volcano. One side of the model of the stratovolcano has been cut away to reveal the magma plumbing system inside. Moving to the right along the counter, there are black, slightly raised distance markers representing 5 kilometer intervals. The last is at 30 kilometers, the maximum width of some stratovolcanoes found in Indonesia. Indonesia is home to many explosive volcanoes, including Tambora, Krakatoa, and Merapi.
Volcanic eruptions, shield volcanoes. With your back to the stratovolcano, cross to the touchable model of a shield volcano opposite, on the facing wall of the gallery. In the centre of the gallery is a high glass panel that shows a continuous film of red-hot magma bubbling and heaving with sound effects. The shield volcano is on a much larger scale. Shield volcanoes can be 4 times as wide as a typical stratovolcano. Distance markers on the tabletop extend to the left in increments of first 10 and then 20 kilometres. Shield volcanoes get their name from their broad, gently sloping shape, which resembles a warrior's shield. The shield volcano shows that the eruption of magma onto Earth's surface isn't always a big explosive event. Shield volcanoes are formed by low to moderate eruptions that release fountains and streams of runny lava. The lava cools and builds up in layers, eventually creating mountains and islands. Effusive eruptions take place when magma is particularly runny, with low gas content, and they don't involve big explosions of ash, rock, and hot gas. Continue left along the shield volcano counter. We come to a glass case containing 3 samples of lava from Hawaii. A'a lava is pinky grey, with a texture like the soft crumb inside a baguette gone stale. A'a lava forms as the surface of a lava flow cools and hardens, while the inner part continues to flow, breaking it into sharp, angular shapes. The second sample, in the centre, is a mass of gleaming golden threads, like something from a fairy tale. It's called Pele's hair, after the Hawaiian goddess of volcanoes. Tiny pieces of magma are thrown in the air and spun by the wind into golden strands of volcanic glass. The third sample is called Pahoehoe lava. Dark brown and ridged, it resembles thick cake batter that's solidified while being mixed. Pahoehoe lava flows down the volcano in oozy steps called toes. As the surface begins to cool and solidify, the lava underneath continues to flow, causing its folded appearance. Just to the left of the glass cabinet, there's a touchable sample of pillow lava. These rounded rocks form when lava cools rapidly in cold seawater. Pillow shapes form as the outside hardens, but the hot inside continues to puff out.
The hazards of volcanoes. Turn your back on the pillow lava and cross the gallery again, veering slightly to the left, to find a touchable lava bomb on the counter opposite. There are benches in the centre of the gallery if you'd like to sit down. We're now back on the side of the gallery describing explosive eruptions. While pillow lava is produced by gentle effusions underwater, lava bombs are lumps of magma shot out from explosive eruptions. This type of lava bomb is known as a bread crust bomb. The size of a large rounded country loaf, the cracked surface of the bread crust bomb gives it its name. The surface hardened after it was flung from the volcano. When it landed on the ground, the surface cracked while the hot insides continued to expand within. To the right of the lava bomb, there is a short section of wall and a white vertical pole like a lamppost. Circle round the pole to come to the next display case on your left-hand side. We now come to the hazards of volcanoes. Most deaths from volcanic eruptions are caused by fast avalanches of burning hot gas, ash and rock, known as pyroclastic flows, one of the most dangerous forces released by an erupting volcano. A column of hot gas and ash is thrown into the air and collapses under its own weight. It then roars down the side of the volcano, moving rapidly and carrying chunks of lava the size of trucks. It burns everything it passes, and the ash can be so thick and heavy that it crushes houses. Reaching a top speed of 725 kilometers per hour, it is almost impossible to outrun. This low glass case from floor to waist height holds the plaster casts of two victims of a pyroclastic flow. In 79 AD, Mount Vesuvius in Italy erupted, discharging a deadly cloud of molten rock, ash and gases. The cloud fell back to earth and buried the Roman cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum, killing thousands. Ash solidified around their bodies, which eventually rotted away. The airspaces formed a mould retaining the imprint of the body and were found by archaeologists more than 1,000 years later. These plaster casts from Pompeii record the final positions of the unfortunate victims. On the left, a large dog with a sturdy collar around its neck lies on its back, convulsed in agony, head contorted towards its tail, four legs stretched out rigidly. To the right of the dog is a man who lies with his back to us, face down where he has fallen. The man's head is turned away, and his left hand is lifted to his face, as if to protect his eyes. Italy is the only country in mainland Europe with active volcanoes. Mount Vesuvius has erupted more than 40 times since the destruction of Pompeii. The city of Naples, home to 3.5 million people, has grown on the volcano's slopes. The volcano is closely monitored for signs of an eruption, and scientists work with local authorities on evacuation plans.
Volcanic rocks. With your back to the Pompeii figures, step a few paces forward to an island in the centre of the gallery. On one side of the table is a 2-metre-high touchable panel, which illustrates the inside of a volcano. The volcano has been cut through the middle, revealing its plumbing system. Smooth channels of red-hot magma force their way up through rough-textured black rock. Magma and lava are the same thing, a mixture of molten rock, loose crystals and gas. Magma occurs under Earth's surface, and lava is the name it's given after it's erupted out of a volcano. When lava and magma cool, they form igneous rocks of two kinds. Plutonic rocks form beneath Earth's surface when magma cools slowly, while volcanic rocks form at Earth's surface when lava cools quickly. The next display shows four types of volcanic rock. They vary enormously in texture and appearance, reflecting their chemical composition and the speed at which they cooled. Facing the panel showing the internal plumbing of a volcano, move around the central island to your right. We come to a table with two touchable specimens of volcanic rock and one inside a glass case. The first large chunk of grey rock with a slightly rough surface is called andesite, because the first rock of its kind to be described was from the Andes volcanoes of South America. Tiny flecks of white crystal are trapped inside the grey rock. These coarse crystals formed slowly inside the magma chamber. They were then carried out of the volcano by lava that cooled quickly to become the grey rock. To the right of the andesite is a large piece of beautiful volcanic glass or obsidian. In a glass case behind these samples, there's a large lump of white pumice. The obsidian is shiny, dense and jet black, while the pumice is riddled with large and small holes and light enough to float on water. Amazingly, these two rocks are both examples of quickly cooled volcanic glass. The magma that formed the obsidian contained very little gas, whereas the pumice was formed from magma rich in gas that violently erupted. When chipped, obsidian is incredibly sharp and has been used for thousands of years to make cutting blades. Pumice is commonly used as an abrasive and in the bathroom. A fourth example of igneous rock stands on a raised plinth at the end of the table. Three matte black six-sided columns just over a metre high and half a metre wide. These are from the Giant's Causeway in Ireland, an area of about 40,000 interlocking basalt columns. The columns were once thick lava that flowed from a fissure and quickly cooled, leaving no time for large crystals to form. The lava shrank to form these hexagonal shapes, similar to the way cracks form in drying mud.
Stepping into the heart of a volcano. With your back to the basalt columns, move forward to the next central island. Directly ahead, mounted on a platform behind glass screens, is a volcanic heat suit. Heat suits protect scientists from the searing temperatures of lava. This suit can withstand temperatures of up to 1,000 degrees Celsius. New and unused, it's made of shiny silver material. The suit has a massive hood that covers the head and shoulders with a transparent visor. The coat comes down to the knee, with sleeves tucked into bulky gloves, and the trousers are tucked into silver boots. This part of the gallery, called Stepping into the Heart of a Volcano, describes the work scientists do in trying to understand volcanoes. Move round the heat suit to the left, and we come to a large screen mounted at waist height. On film, a tiny silver-clad figure is at the edge of a vast boiling pit of lava, called a lava lake. Roped up like a mountaineer, the scientist cautiously clambers over the rocks to gather samples. Scientists collect samples of gas and lava and speak to local people to build up a picture of each volcano's activity. 80 observatories around the world survey high-risk volcanoes and help people prepare for eruptions. In 2013, scientists from the Natural History Museum went to Mexico to assess an active stratovolcano called Popocatépetl. This volcano stands close to the 11.5 million people living in Mexico City and is considered one of the most hazardous volcanoes in the world. Research trips like this one build knowledge of how volcanoes change over time and make scientists more able to predict a potentially destructive eruption. To the left of the screen is a bench. A wall-mounted screen opposite displays photographs. You can take a seat here and continue to listen as two members of the trip, volcanologist Dr. Chiara Maria Petrone and curator David Smith, describe their experiences in Mexico.
Popocatépetl is a very active volcano. When I say very active, it means that it's constantly erupting since 1994. Popocatépetl has a strange behavior. It's a sort of schizophrenic behavior. All of a sudden, it starts to have a very big eruption. And the cause why this volcano is changing from medium eruption to the big one is not known. Or it's not really well understood. So I'm trying to get some insight on this and see if we can get an idea why.
Yes, we had a professor from the local university who has a very advanced knowledge of Popocatépetl. So we were using his knowledge to take us to the appropriate outcrops where we could collect the samples that we needed.
A typical day in the field starts very early, particularly when we have to climb up to the top of the volcano. We start at 5 in the morning and we start climbing. And the idea is that since we carry our rock in our rucksack, we just climb it up to the top and then we start collecting rock in the way down to make a little bit less effort and to be able to reach the very top of the volcano, almost the top. At the base of the volcano, you have all the vegetation and a quite tall tree. And then as long when you start climbing, the vegetation gets more shorter. And then at some point, there is no vegetation at all. There is all this loose material, which is very, very hard to work on, and all the ash. And the other thing is the altitude, that is very, very difficult to manage.
The actual scenery that we saw was so diverse. So there was one day where we were walking up through what was like a moonscape with rocks and pumice absolutely everywhere. There was so little vegetation, just sort of tufts of yellowish grass, and it was really hard going. Another day we actually walked up a river valley, and the river valley got narrower and narrower and became like a gorge, probably no more than 6 to 10 feet across, and you could barely see the sky above us. And then we were just kept going through this gap, through this chasm, until we were obstructed by a waterfall, and that was as far as we could go.
Plate tectonics. From the Mexican field trip display, turn to your right and continue to the second section of the gallery. A recording of geologist Professor Ian Stewart can be heard as he narrates the short film that introduces the plate tectonics section of the gallery. A small wooden bench faces a screen showing the 6-minute film on a continuous loop. If you'd like to listen to this film, you can pause this guide. Earth's surface is broken into huge slabs of rock called tectonic plates. They're constantly on the move, albeit very slowly, powered by the immense heat radiating from the planet's centre. This dynamic process is called plate tectonics, and it's responsible for creating our oceans, land, earthquakes and volcanoes. On the same island as the bench facing the film, there's a tactile map at waist height that uses braille, raised lettering and symbols to show the seas and continents of Earth and the boundaries of the tectonic plates. The map shows 3 ways in which tectonic plates meet. They can rub past one another, known as a transform boundary, pull apart from each other, a divergent boundary, or push into each other, a convergent boundary. Wherever this happens, faults can open up, leading to earthquakes or volcanoes. The map shows some familiar fault lines, such as the San Andreas Fault, a transform fault running down the west coast of the United States.
Evolution when plates move. Turning to the right, away from the tactile map, walk 5 paces forward to the next central display case. When plates move, continents and oceans move with them. As land splits apart and living creatures of the same species become separated by oceans, they gradually evolve into distinct species. This head-height glass case contains 3 taxidermy specimens, an animal on the left and 2 birds on the right. The smaller of the 2 birds is an ostrich chick, about 40 centimetres tall. It has a small head, long curved neck with a pattern of light spots, oval-shaped body, and long legs with backward-facing knees. Not yet fully fledged, its feathers are the colour and texture of shredded wheat. The bird standing behind it is a young rhea, similar to the ostrich but taller, with a larger head and soft brown feathers. Ostriches live in Africa, and rheas live in South America. Neither bird can fly, and they evolved from the same ancestor. So how come they live so far apart? The answer is their common ancestor lived when the two continents were connected. As populations of their ancestor were separated, they evolved into the different species that live today. In contrast to these long-separated cousins, the animal poking its nose towards us on the left of the case is one of a kind. The short-beaked echidna, or spiny anteater, has tiny eyes and a short rubbery snout, which serves as both nose and mouth. Its dark fur is hidden by hollow, barbless spines, and its short legs end in strong, sharp claws. The echidna is a mammal with a peculiar feature. It lays eggs. Along with many other species like the koala and kangaroo, the echidna is only found in Australia. This is because the continent was isolated for 35 million years due to the movement of Earth's plates.
Earth's interior. Moving around the glass case and forward to the next central island, we come to a tactile model of Earth, about a metre in diameter. The surface of the globe is mainly covered by the blue of the oceans, while the ridges of continental mountain ranges can be felt under the fingertips. A wedge-shaped quadrant has been cut out of the globe to reveal Earth's interior, its different layers distinguished by colour and texture and labelled with raised black lettering. There are three main layers: the crust on which we live, the mantle beneath it, and the core. The mantle is coloured red, the outer core is orange, and the inner core yellow. The centre of Earth is as hot as the surface of the sun. The heat radiating from the core can split open the surface and create volcanoes and earthquakes. Energy from the core heats the rock in the mantle layer, making it viscous, so that it behaves like a thick liquid. Heating of the mantle causes the viscous rock to move around slowly, a process called convection. Convection pushes and pulls the tectonic plates just above. Moving round the globe to the left, we come to a meteorite. It's made of iron and nickel. The surface is very dark grey, with an uneven but smooth texture. There are silvery gleams on the top edge where the touch of visitors' hands has burnished the metal. Touching it is the closest you'll come to handling a piece of Earth's core, as it's made of the same material. Iron meteorites can tell us a lot about our own core, as they're thought to be fragments from the core of larger asteroids formed at the same time as Earth. On the left-hand wall, facing the meteorite, a glass case at waist height contains a massive sample of granite, about the size of a suitcase. Next to it is a Geiger counter, with its detector tube pointing at the rock. Press the button on the tabletop in front to hear an auditory measure of the radioactivity of the rock. The faster it clicks, the greater the radioactivity measured. Some granite contains a small amount of uranium, one of Earth's radioactive elements.
Earthquakes. Move along the tabletop and follow it round the corner to the left to enter the third section of the gallery on earthquakes. Earthquakes occur without warning, causing death and destruction on a massive scale. They may feel sudden and violent, but they're caused by the incredibly slow movement of vast tectonic plates. As these plates move, pressure builds up until something finally gives way. By understanding how and where they occur, scientists can help us prepare for future earthquakes and limit the damage they cause. Mounted at the entrance to the earthquake section, a display case contains a painted wooden box, an interactive model of a few hundred meters of land with grass, a road, and an undulating river on top. A fault line, a cut that divides the wooden box into two, crosses both road and river. The side of the box is painted in three wide stripes to represent geological strata. Below the box on the front of the display case, there's a small metal handle. Turn this clockwise to create your own earthquake. As you wind the handle, pressure builds along the fault line. The growing pressure is shown by a needle in a pressure gauge at the back of the case. The needle moves through green, amber, and red zones until finally one section of land slides past the other with a loud rumble. The strata below the surface jump out of alignment. Just as with a real earthquake, you can't predict exactly when it will break. This is an example of a reverse fault earthquake. Two tectonic plates push into each other, and one is eventually thrust upwards.
Measuring earthquakes. With your back to the model earthquake, you'll find a bench some 5 paces ahead. This part of the guide describes the history of earthquakes and how they're measured before we move on to the next display. A good analogy for the way earthquakes occur is clicking your fingers. When you click your fingers, friction between your fingertips allows you to increase the pressure until it's suddenly released. In the same way, friction between rocks near Earth's surface allows pressure to build up slowly over time. When the pressure becomes too great, the slabs of rock jump or snap, releasing a massive pulse of energy known as a seismic wave. The rocks vibrate back and forth for a while before coming to a stop, the shaking we feel as an earthquake. The exact point where an earthquake starts underground is called the focus. The closer the focus is to the surface, the stronger the earthquake feels to us. The point on the surface directly above the focus is the epicenter. Throughout history, people have tried to understand what causes earthquakes. The ancient Greek philosopher and mathematician Aristotle thought that underground winds whipped up the occasional shaking of Earth's surface. Hindu mythology held that Earth was carried on the backs of 8 giant elephants. When one grew weary, it would lower its head, causing an earthquake. Japanese folklore described a giant catfish that lived in mud beneath the surface. The catfish was restrained by the god Kashima, but when he relaxed his guard, the catfish thrashed about, causing the ground to shake. It wasn't until the 1960s that scientists finally discovered the link between earthquakes and the movement of plates. Scientists had no standard way to compare earthquakes until 1935, when Charles Richter developed his famous Richter scale. The scale runs up to 10. It's logarithmic, so an increase of 1 point on the scale means the size of the seismic wave increases 10 times. Most earthquakes have a small magnitude and may not even be felt. While the Richter scale measures the magnitude of the shaking, the Mercalli scale measures the amount of damage caused to people and buildings. The 12 categories are labelled instrumental, weak, slight, moderate, rather strong, very strong, destructive, violent, intense, extreme, and catastrophic. Usually, the higher an earthquake's magnitude, the greater the devastation, especially when it strikes near populated areas. But a big earthquake could have a low Mercalli value if its focus is far below Earth's surface, it occurs in a sparsely populated area, or if people are well prepared and buildings supported. Earthquakes are too sudden and complex for us to predict precisely when one will take place. Some believe the best way to reduce their impact is simply to be prepared.
Detecting earthquakes. The science of seismology studies seismic waves, the powerful shock waves created by earthquakes. On the left-hand wall opposite the bench, there is a screen showing live earthquake data from the past 7 days as red dots on a world map. The larger the dot, the greater the magnitude of the earthquake. In a floor-level glass case further along the left-hand wall, there are 2 seismoscopes, or earthquake detectors, both on loan from the Science Museum. On the left is a model of one of the first earthquake detectors built in 132 AD by the Chinese mathematician Zhang Heng. The original detector has been lost for centuries, and only descriptions of it remain. This reconstruction is a large bronze vessel about 1/2 meter high with a domed lid, resembling a wine jar. Dragons poke their heads out of the vessel around its top edge, while large frogs squat on the floor around the outside, their open mouths turned upwards towards the dragons. When an earthquake hit, shaking the vessel, a ball would pop out of one of the dragon's mouths to be caught by a frog. The dragons were set at the 8 compass points around the vessel, so the dragon that released the ball indicated the direction of the earthquake. In the original, the machinery was hidden inside. But this reconstruction has a cutaway back, with a mirror behind it, to reveal the mechanism. Next to this ancient device is a brass seismograph from 1885. It was designed by Thomas Gray and John Milne while they were studying earthquakes in Japan, and was made in Glasgow. 3 weights mounted on movable arms correspond to the 3 dimensions of space. The machine records vibrations in each of the dimensions using 3 pens that trace lines on a continuous length of paper. The steady unrolling of the paper is controlled by a large clock at the front of the seismograph.
Earthquake simulator. From the glass case containing the seismoscopes, continue along the left-hand wall to enter the earthquake simulator, based on the Kobe earthquake of 1995. The floor slopes up, and to the left there's a handrail. Above your head, a sign reads Kobe Supermarket. The reconstruction of this Japanese supermarket lines the walls of a rectangular room about 6 meters across. Visitors stand in the centre of the space. Follow the handrail around to find a comfortable place to wait for the next tremor. If you don't wish to enter the simulator, turn away from the seismoscopes and cross to the opposite wall of the gallery. Beyond the handrail, there's a reconstruction of a Japanese supermarket in 1995. There are shelves displaying brightly coloured plastic bowls, chopsticks and bamboo steamers, packets of noodles, bottles of soy sauce and cans of Asahi beer, shopping trolleys and baskets. As the floor of the supermarket begins to shake, lights flash. Bottles rattle on the shelves. TV screens on the wall, high above the shelves and tucked into the shopping trolleys, show security camera footage from supermarkets in Kobe, Japan, in 1995. Customers stagger and stumble to the ground. Goods fall from shelves. The far side of the simulator shows the destruction that the earthquake wrought, with fallen girders, sheets of corrugated metal and broken signs. Follow the handrail round and go down the slope to leave the supermarket and re-enter the main gallery.
The dangers after an earthquake. To your right, there is a bench facing the final part of the exhibition. The danger from an earthquake doesn't stop once the ground has stopped shaking. Fires and landslides can cause further damage and loss of life. But the biggest threat comes from the sea. If an earthquake strikes underwater, it can trigger a giant wave called a tsunami, which can flood inland for many kilometres. On the wall opposite, a large screen shows film and CCTV footage of the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami in March 2011, which devastated the northeast coast of Japan, killing more than 16,000 people. Running clockwise, the screens show the initial earthquake, the tsunami's approach, its impact, and the aftermath. Film taken before the disaster shows the small fishing town of Minrami Sanriku at the bottom of a valley, with mainly low-rise buildings on either side of a shallow river running down to the sea. The earthquake struck in the early afternoon. Shoppers are shown clinging to rails of clothing in a department store. Office workers dodge falling cabinets and bookshelves. Newscasters in a television studio broadcast warnings wearing protective helmets as the studio shudders and rocks around them. But there is no protection against the huge tsunami wave which approaches the shore shortly after the earthquake. The huge wall of water sweeps quickly through the town, carrying everything before it. Houses are lifted from their foundations and smashed to matchwood. Cars, boats and planes are carried inland for kilometres by the raging torrent. In a glass case opposite the screen are items retrieved from a damaged house, one of the few buildings that remained once the tsunami had retreated. A large square clock face is cracked down the middle, the hands missing. A calendar open to the March 2011 page is stained with a faint watermark, showing the height of the water that surged into the house. In the days and weeks following an earthquake, water supplies can be interrupted. To the left of the calendar is a blue life straw, a little longer and thicker than a normal drinking straw, and containing filters that clean contaminated water before it reaches the mouth. Searching for survivors of earthquakes is difficult and dangerous work. Dogs are often used as they have a great sense of smell and can reach places humans can't. These life-saving dogs are kitted out with their own hard-wearing footwear. Above the blue life straw are four small red and black protective paw covers worn by the rescue dogs.
Personal experiences. A final panel at the exit from the gallery displays comments by people who've experienced earthquakes around the world. Jorge from Chile says, "It was tremendous. Fortunately, houses in my district withstood the force of the shake. It started with a great noise. Then, as seconds went by, the quake became so strong that it was difficult to stay on our feet. When my wife was able to open the door, the pavement looked like a serpent quickly sliding on the ground." Alicia from the USA says, "Where I live in California, earthquakes are pretty common. I've been in two earthquakes. Feeling the ground move beneath your feet is weird, but if you know what to do, it's not quite as scary. Learning to drop, cover your head and hold on is the first thing you should do when the earth starts moving." Stefan from New Zealand says, "Time seemed to stand still during the quake. When I think about everything I did during the 40 seconds of shaking, it almost seems superhuman. Years of training had me dive for cover, but then I found myself mesmerized as I watched the solid structures around me move like fluid." As you leave the gallery, you're invited to respond to the question, "Have you experienced an earthquake?" by pressing a button, yes to the left, no to the right. Two digital displays show the running tally of visitors' responses. That's the end of this audio descriptive guide to the Volcanoes and Earthquakes Gallery. Turn from this panel to your left to leave the gallery. To the right is a balustrade overlooking the vast atrium where we joined the escalator. Directly ahead is the entrance to the Restless Surface Gallery. Restless Surface explores the powerful forces that shape and reshape Earth's surface and features touchable rock samples and a giant stalagmite. To the left is a marble staircase leading down two stories to the Exhibition Road entrance. If you prefer to take the lift, retrace your steps through the Volcanoes and Earthquakes Gallery.